You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and if you're a fan of the show, this forthcoming conversation, can something be forthcoming if it's immediate? The ensuing conversation that you're about to hear with me and the fabulous comedian Tom Ward, I think is destined to become a favourite of yours. This is absolute ComCom catnip as we discuss the balance that Tom enjoys between his gleeful absorption in the creative process and how incredibly robustly he manages his mental health. Tom does a lot of things to keep himself mentally on the straight and narrow that you or I might think, oh, it would be good if I did that. He actually does them, and we'll find out exactly how and why, up to and including using a burner phone so that he can't get distracted by phones. Mwah! That's probably what the people that invented phones do. You can catch up with Tom at tomwardvoice.com or follow him at tomwardcomedian on Instagram or Facebook. And his Edinburgh show is called Anthem. It's at the Monkey Barrel at the Edinburgh Fringe this year. That's 2022. If you're listening in the future, that's when you missed it. It's 10:25 nightly, but not every nightly. So go to the Monkey Barrel website to find out how you get tickets for that. My own show is, as you probably just heard on a recent advert, 1:25 p.m. at the Monkey Barrel from the 4th to the 11th. But there are 25 minutes of extra content from this episode on the therapeutic value of comedy for good or ill, keeping ambiguity accessible, and mine and Tom's shared desire to write a joke so good that we don't die alone. All of that on the Insiders feed at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Now, let's get stuck in to Tom Ward. Welcome to the show, Tom Ward. You are a fucking heroic comedian. I tell you what I mean by that. You are exactly what I like in a comedian. You are witty and warm and open-hearted and vulnerable and actually talking about the world and the way you see it in an honest way and doing so in a really, really funny way. That is my starting point.
Wow. I wish the Times agreed with you, and I wish the Telegraph agreed with you, and I wish all of the broadsheets don't agree with me. They often tell me that I don't have heart, which is
they tell you you don't have heart,
which makes my heart hurt a lot. I've had sort of stern chats with comedians who've been going a long time, saying, you know, someone like Jeff will take me aside, Jeff Innocent, who said, "Tom, lovely shit, Tom, but." Where's the heart? There's no heart in there. And I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake.
No.
So, yes. Yeah,
I don't agree with that at all. Do you? Well, look, the only important critic here is you. Do you agree with it? Do you think, you don't need to agree with all the kind of effusive praise, but do you think there's heart and
vulnerability?
I agree
fully with your summary, your preface. I thought that was second to none. I don't know. I always thought I did. I always thought, because I care so much about it. It matters so much to me, and I feel so completely present that I just think maybe people's version of what heart means is different to mine sometimes. I feel like maybe they mean that you have to be clearly first-person-y talking about your life for it to clearly be heart. And I think I'm quite reluctant to do that. It doesn't really work when I do. So I sort of feel that if I'm sideways, perhaps maybe they don't see that it's actually me saying it about what I feel or what my life's been like or whatever.
Yeah.
So I feel like maybe the heart isn't always spotted. Especially among people that are clearly signposting their emotional experience in a way that's more, here we are, here's some heart. And I don't mean that in a cynical way. I just mean that they're maybe more straight up about their feelings. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. That's interesting you use the phrase first person. I feel I know exactly what you mean, and that's not a way that people often talk about stand-up, because it all appears to be first person. But some of the type of material I associate with you is almost, it's like describing the world. It's like this, you do this, don't you? And then they say that, and then you do this, and you pick one of these up. You know what I mean? Like, you're sort of framed, which is almost a third-person thing. So I think you may be right in that supposition that that people then don't, critics don't, or whoever, don't necessarily realise that you are talking about yourself, because you're sort of framing it like at arm's length.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Maybe that's not the right way of saying it, but by placing, it's almost like if you, where you put the camera, most stand-ups put the camera such that we see their worldview.
Yeah.
If it was a movie, we'd be seeing the world through their eyes.
Yeah.
But you're seeing it happening to someone else, but because you're the auteur, we know it's about you, or we should know it's about you.
Yeah, I mean, I recently had a director, we worked together for one session, and she dismantled the whole show and said she didn't like it. And one of the things she said, "Where are you in it, darling? Where are you in it?" And I was like, "Oh God, not this again."
Oh.
So I love hearing that people find the heart in it, but I also go, "Oh Jesus." But and yet this seems to be the one thing that keeps coming up in terms of the issue from the people who are really looking at it. Go, "Yes, it's great. We love it, or we like what you're doing, and it's we're having a jolly time here, but you know, we're not coming away with a real sense or a real nugget in the bag, you know?"
And is that just about, because I don't agree with that, but because I think that stuff is there and it is on display. Is it that comedy audiences like you to be more, like one, to be like, to sort of, do you know that essay thing of say what you're going to say, say it, and then say that you've said it? Like, do comedy audiences need you to come out on stage and say, "I feel sad about this," or "I feel hopeful about this"? And if you tack that on to what you're doing, they'll suddenly go, "Oh, it was full of heart, because I like the subtlety, and I like the fact you draw us in, and I like the fact there's a maze to be explored."
Yeah, I do feel like they do want some structure, and structure is not my speciality. I was listening back to a recording from 2018, a show I did, a sort of show that I wasn't very confident about looking back. I looked back on it as my worst show. And I listened back to it last night and I was laughing because I'd forgotten everything that I, you know, most of it I hadn't been doing since. And I was attempting to do structure. I had this thread running through it of musicians who are confessing to be a nonce in their lyrics. So just the songs from the 60s onwards of, you know, men saying, "Hey, little girl, is your daddy home?" And all that sort of stuff. And I just thought, oh, there's paedophile Bruce Springsteen there. And that was my way of saying, here's some structure. There's a nonce theme running through. And so things like that, I was, you know, reoccurring bits, or, you know, I was trying to do summaries at the end of bits, or, and this is how my perspective changed. And every time I saw myself doing that, I just sort of felt I felt going cold. I was like, oh no, what? No. Because I don't see it in that way. I don't know if anyone does, but maybe some people are good at pretending that they're able to sort of say, so here's my premise for the show, and here's what I've learned, and as you say, here's the premise revisited, and we can all go home, you know. But I don't experience life like that. It's just a series of weird moments.
I feel like one of the things I love about you is the collage. So we get your world, and we get the kind of, there's, you know, the analogy of, God, we'll talk about this in a bit. You're so good at analogies. That thing about middle class people, if you tiptoe over the gravel, they can't hear you. Forgive me, I'm spoiling a joke here. But they haven't uploaded their personality, and it's like opening a dishwasher before the cycle finishes. That's such a good analogy. That's so, like, to me, that's like, oh, I know who you are. You're the guy who notices that and says it in that way. That's who you are. Like, that's, you know, character is plot. This is a Mamet thing I'm obsessed with. Character is plot. Actors look at the script and go, what's my character? And you get, Mamet would say, no, the character is all the decisions you make.
Right.
If you're the guy that bent down to pick up the dog, or you're the guy that decided not to do the heist, that's all the information you give the actor. That's your character, the plot.
Right, right.
So
right.
I get that. I see that from you. But I'm getting off topic. You talked about, so that a director or someone would say, we were talking about structure. And I don't think structure is entirely, it is what I mean, but it's only part of what I mean, whereby I think some comics come out and say, the world is like this, and I am like this. And they kind of, they underline everything in a way that I feel often they get away with, and people clap and go, oh, that's clever, they told us. And I don't want it all on a plate.
No, that's not how the world is. And I think the more sure you sound, the less sure I am of you, to be honest. I mean, I think...
God, very well put. Yes, totally agree with that.
Because that's not how life is. If you're sure, then you're doing something wrong, you know? And if you're 26 and you're a nice-looking middle-class kid talking with certainty, I just go, well, fine, that's not for me. That's not my world. That was not that's not where I was when I was 26. And, you know, how dare you even be sure about anything? You shouldn't even be saying hello with certainty. You should be, trembling with terror, even feeling like saying hello's all right. I just feel like people get rewarded for being for having a low low emotional frequency. You know, there's like this patting on the back. If you can show your workings, that's more important than other things in some ways. At times, not all the times, and I wouldn't generalize, because there are brilliant talents who are. Someone like Spencer Jones is a clown, and he gets all the praise and success he deserves by being bonkers, and from it being one thing to another, and we go, oh, where's he going next? And we just, it's delicious, and we want to go there wherever it is. So it's not the constant thing, but sometimes I feel like if you show your workings, they're like, oh, very good, very good. And I don't have that. I don't have that skill. I wasn't very good at school. I can't get my head around the intellectual side of it very well. I just want it to feel thrilling. You know, from one moment to the next, I want it to feel exciting. And where are we going? What's happening now? And try and join it together as best I can without it being clunky.
I suppose that the next thing that makes me think is, you can do that, because in stand-up we can all just do what we want. The only clash there is with a potential kind of, it's a clash of the marketplace, isn't it? Like if you are doing your art and enjoying your art and embracing it and saying the world how you see it, the only thing that matters if someone were to go, if a critic or a director were to go, oh, but what is it? You know, what is it? Is it in there? Is this the case that all that would make a difference to is the marketability of it? And how important is that to you? Because I think probably most artists have to go, this is the way I see the world. But if I want to be successful, I have to either be so incredible that I like Prince, do you know what I mean? That I kind of bring along everyone to my world.
Yeah.
Or that you go, well, here's the reality and the fuzziness and the confusingness of it all, and I've got to slightly knock the edges off in order that I then get on telly or, you know, build whatever. Well, I mean, that's a very flowery question, but
I know what you mean. It's like Kitson is Prince, isn't he? He's the guy that plays all the instruments, does his own, plays the bass, i.e. sends his own mailing list out, you know, does the drums, manages himself. It's all him. And it's like, well, when you are that brilliant, but he know, it's like when you know you're brilliant, and when the world is telling you you're brilliant, you can trust that you don't need an agent anymore, and you can trust that you can do your own marketing, because the feedback you're getting is so strong and so clear that it's undeniable. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's a lot of people sort of scrambling around for the territory. It feels like, you know, except for people like him, there's a lot of other people in what feels to be like a kind of a pot, you know, scrambling around and feeling that they have to define themselves by the usual means. And that eventually everyone gets kind of worn down by what becomes the norm. So you see it in surgery. People have lip jobs eventually because they're like, well, fucking hell, everyone's got these lips. I better have these lips. And it's like, now I'm on Instagram as well. I don't have a smartphone, but I'm on Instagram and I do my, you know, I do all that stuff. And it's like, I find myself getting caught up in it, going, oh, fucking hell, I used to hate all this. And now I'm part of this thing of, oh, you must put out a reel, you must put out a picture, you must do stories, you must, you know. And it's like, you can see how, unless you are absolutely flying and almost deranged in how lopsided you are towards the thing, you feel that you have to play some sort of game or sort of be aware of your brand and where to position yourself and all this kind of bollocks.
But all of those things are, I think it does it, I'll ask that question the other way around. Does that simply come back to the marketplace, or is it about the kind of the fan base? Because if you want to do the work, that's the thing. For me, I want to be selling tickets. Not because I want loads of money from tickets, but because I want to play to full rooms. I want to feel like I'm a success. So that's why I would then try and do, and it's come up on the podcast a few times recently, I've just started doing Instagram off the back of this massively viral clip of me on someone else's reel, someone else's page. And nice. I've tried to sort of spin that into creating, you know, and I've had a couple of viral things, and then of late, not so much. And I felt myself go, oh, well, this was very easy, and I felt very objective about it when it was flying, and
yeah.
I hate it again. I'm like, oh, God, this is awful. But like, for me, the motivation to do that is to get it seen by people.
Yeah.
So maybe it isn't just about selling, you know, shifting units, selling tickets, becoming a glitzy famous person. Because, again, I think, you know, I do think at my core, the experience of performing to a nice full room, doing new stuff you care about and are excited by, is the same sensual experience, whether it's 50 people or 5,000 people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I shouldn't care at all, because I want to be an artist and I want to do the stuff, but we sort of end up caring.
I know what you mean. And sensual is a lovely word for it as well. I think it's like, you've done 50 people, and then once you've done 5,000, you go, right, okay, we've moved to the next level here. This is the level. So it's like you were saying the other day to Brett Goldstein about, once someone's absolutely ripped for a role in a film, they then have the pressure of keeping the body.
Yeah.
You know, it's like,
that's never been more relevant.
And you've been training yourself, I heard you saying. So it's like, once you start making progress, you're like, oh, fuck, if I was just in mediocrity forever, then I'd be fine, because there's no real drop from that. I mean, the drop is less seismic than dropping from greatness.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, shit, I've really, you know, I've put myself in it now, because I've got this newer, higher standard as norm.
But isn't that just another illusion? Are we not people of art, Tom? Like, that is just an illusion, isn't it?
Of course it is. Of course it is. But it's so tricky distancing yourself from the illusion when the illusion is coming at you all the time from all angles. You know, and we're constantly being told to live in the illusion, give into the illusion, and play the game. And you've got to try and remember that it's a game. And sometimes it's really hard. Sometimes it's utterly absorbing. You know, I swear, if Jesus was alive now, he'd probably have a little glance at his Insta page. You know, he'd probably if Jesus and Buddha were alive at the same time, there would probably be some sort of rivalry, and Buddha would be meditating, and he'd find his thoughts drifting towards, how's Jesus doing on Insta compared to him? You know, and he'd be like, what is going on here? You know, this is a man that's not had a thought for 6 months, and then suddenly it creeps, you know what I mean? It creeps in, and you're like, fuck. And it's just, yeah, you got to keep pushing back, haven't you? You got to keep remembering, oh, hang on, this is just a computer game. I'm playing a computer game. I can pop down the remote, you know, and go and have a breather, because this isn't real. But as long as you're aware that it's a game, I think that it's okay.
I think it must be, some of the people I'm most envious of in comedy are people who are kind of post-fame, who can say, well, I did the arenas and I didn't like it. Do you know what I mean? Because then they don't have to do the arenas, because they can have an opinion about it from the perspective of having done it. They go, well, I did QI for 20 years and you know, I'm happier now in my shed noodling around in my stuff. I don't know who these people are, but that's kind of, because I'm happy, you know, in doing the equivalent of noodling in my shed.
Yeah.
It's just that I'll never know if I'd have felt differently noodling in my shed if I'd had 20 years on QI beforehand whatever the status thing is.
And no one will take seriously if you say, well, I thought about doing 20 years on QI, but do you know what, I just know that it's an illusion, so I'm going to go and hang out in my shed.
But
it's like, yeah, right, you just couldn't get there, you couldn't get
totally
there.
totally. But again, that sort of factoring into the grand illusion, if you did have the wherewithal, and I think that's what Kitson's got, he has the self-belief, this is purely from the outside, I think he appears to have the self-belief where he can go, well, I, you know, it's almost like he's the only one of us who has the moxie to go, not even the moxie, just the sheer rock confidence in himself, ostensibly from the outside, to go, yeah, I'd rather do that than 20 years on QI, because I know that I'd end up in that point. So almost, and that's part of the kind of the myth of Kitson, isn't it? That's why his name is whispered in circles, because by being, in the same way, I think Eddie Izzard, apparently, when they initially didn't do TV.
Yeah.
You know, Eddie didn't do TV. And so if you wanted to see Eddie, you had to go live.
Yes.
And like, imagine making that decision now and going, well, I'm not doing TV. And you could believe it in your heart. And then 20 years later, people would go, well done, you didn't do TV. No one knew who you were.
Yeah.
No one made a pilgrimage to you.
Yeah, your protest is useless unless someone heard it.
Yeah, right.
It's like boycotting something. Do you boycott Greg's, or do you go in and buy the vegan sausage roll? You know, which one's better? Which one's cleaner? It's like, if no one's listening, who cares about your little protest? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I think if you're, you know, I think Kitson, I think anyone who has their own thing like that, it's not, it's a combination of a million factors, and you're getting your feedback from the world all the time about what they want from you, what they'll let you get away with, you know, what they think you are, where you stand. And he kind of knows, he's done some TV, didn't like it, but also was so brilliant that there was so much buzz around him that I think it's like a constant little cuddle from mummy saying, go on, you can do it. And yeah. I don't have that. I don't have that sense that I'm invincible, that people will come, people will find me, because I get enough feedback that says, you know, there's work to be done. There's still work to be done, a lot of work to be done. And you have to trust your own feedback loop. And yes, he's exceptional. There are lots of exceptional comedians. Well, there's a handful, shall we say, of exceptional comedians. And he's the one guy that doesn't seem to have needed any of that stuff after a point. And that's just his particular thing. It's not, you can't replicate that, because that's his feedback that he's responding to. And my feedback is, I've had a preview recently that I had to pull because only six people came. So I can't swan around saying, no, I won't do QI. I won't.
So this is Tom. I love it. I love how sensitively he's exploring things. I love that he's nuanced. I love that he's ambiguous in loads of different ways. And I really am enjoying that sense that, I tell you what I, as an interviewer, am really enjoying. I love talking to people who are brilliant about why they don't think they're brilliant. I think if there was a sort of tagline for this, a log line or whatever it's called, for this podcast, it would be that: getting people who are absolutely brilliant and inspiring on the show, finding out that they don't think they're all that, and then trying to work out why. Mwah! Absolute music to my ears. So just a reminder, Tom's show, Anthem, is at the Monkey Barrel at the Edinburgh Fringe for the whole run, but not every night, at 10:25. My own show is at 1:25 for just the first week, the 4th to the 11th. I hope I shall see you there. And you can catch up with Tom at Tom Ward Voice or on Instagram at Tom Ward Comedian. My own Instagram handle, as you know, is at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy. But if you look at the show notes for this episode, I don't know whether it's an improvement or a dog's breakfast. In the show notes, I've had to put, you can find links to my show at Edinburgh, podcast community links, social media handles and comedy clips, and my new official YouTube channel. Talk about that at the end. All via linktree/Stuart Goldsmith or via comedianscomedian.com and stuartgoldsmith.com. So there's so many links and so many sites. Christ, will no one help me manage my very mangled funnel? I'm getting there, but I don't know if it's any better. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get all the extra content from Tom about his Casio Beats, which are stolen by his own admission. His stolen Casio Beats, keeping his ambiguity accessible. Accessible ambiguity! Mwah! That, do you remember the episode with Jonathan Coulton where we talked about finding the mundane in the monstrous? Come on, this is just, it's pure com-com. So get it straight into your veins in just a second. If you are, what would I normally talk about now? I think I've done all the things I would normally talk about. I'm just sort of quite enjoying this one. I've just recently had a coffee, as you can probably tell. And I've just thought of something to talk about in the postamble. School reports. Remind me when we get there. Let's get back to Tom Ward. Let's talk about your feedback loop. Because we had a very memorable to me interaction. We were messaging one another after that comedy store gig.
Oh, I thought you'd
which was
that.
Like the 500th birthday of the comedy store or something. And it was like a crazy lineup of, I think Paul Merton opened, and do you know what I mean? McIntyre was there and Bishop was there, and you know, just like a galaxy of stars.
Jack D. Ahmed.
And I messaged you afterwards completely without agenda to say, that was hysterical. Oh my God, you did brilliantly. And you texted back something like, we both know that was a death. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to get this guy on the podcast, because what the fuck are you talking about? And I was like, I was there with Addie van der Borg, Ben Norris, someone else, like proper, you know, my era, comedy store headliners, the people you want to be like. And we were all killing ourselves laughing at you. And then you said something like, well, you're very kind. And I was like, here we go. What's going on inside Tom's mind? How do you look back on that show now? Because that was unequivocally brilliant.
Do you know what? Wow. Do you know what? That night, that day after, I think you, did you message me that night late or the next day? But I was so appreciative. I thought, oh, this guy is so... I just thought that is a lot, bearing in mind, I thought I'd had a horrible gig. Either way, it was just nice because you're like this mythical character that kind of floats around talking to people, doing your shows, doing podcasts. And I was like, wow, you know, the doctor has messaged me. Private doctor. And this, you know, and I was like, wow, this is so sweet. And then I thought, well, is he humoring me? Because, you know, I'm in the paranoid state. I was heartbroken after that gig. I went backstage and I cried. I was basically nearly in tears as I came off stage, and I went back into the little the area directly behind the stage in the Comedy Store. So next to the green room, there's a kind of
the little rat run, the kind of place like where a the fuse servers box. Are.
Yeah, yeah, it's like don't come in here through high voltage, that kind of room.
Yeah.
Loose tiles around and that sort of stuff. And I'm like, all right, I'll go in here for a cry. So, and then it became a big cry. And then, you know, the sound engineers were walking behind me and just getting on with putting cables away. And then my agent came in and gave me a little cuddle, and I was a mess. I was a mess because I felt like it was like an absolute, it was such an honor to be asked to do the Comedy Store's 500th birthday. And with all those big bollocks on the lineup, you know, wheeling out the big boys. And then me, towards the end, I know, but I was just like, wow.
It was a totally thankless place on the bill. Did you follow Jack D?
I followed.
Who did you follow?
I followed Rich Hall.
Right, yeah,
and he overran. He did 25 minutes. He was supposed to do 10. And I thought, oh, you bastard.
What was fascinating to me about that was that you were, I remember at the time, the only bits I remember were you did something about having a raven on a gauntlet.
A glove, yeah.
A glove.
Yeah, and I was describing female fantasies being more being more layered than male fantasies.
But this is it. You were talking with nuance and kind of depth and richness. And it was like there was a lot of kind of very highly skilled, broad observational stand-up from famous people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And to have, like, you stuck to your guns. And I remember thinking, he is not pandering to these people at all. You're playing it for you.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that you were dying inside. And I don't think any of us did. None of us knew. None of us could tell. And of course, that awful thing in comedy is that you know what your greatest gig is like. And anything that falls short of that in that environment, you're going to feel like is terrible.
Yeah.
But I hadn't seen you for a couple of years and was just in awe. I thought it was just fantastic.
That's amazing.
So I just think that feedback loop is so... sort of dangerous. How long did it take you to come out of that the next day? If we accept your version of events, which is wrong and stupid.
Well, it wasn't the next day, let's just say that. And I didn't wear the t-shirt that I wore on stage for about 6 months. I retired the t-shirt. I've only recently started wearing it again. And that's nearly 3 years ago, I think it was 2019.
And
I've only started wearing it again, but every time I put it on, I'm a bit nervous that, you know, it might affect my day or that I might revert to type 2019.
Oh, that fucking t-shirt, man.
Yeah. But I was very low for a few weeks, actually. It was one of the hardest reactions I've had to a gig. I've not had gigs where I come off stage feeling as disappointed very often as that. I would say that's probably top 2-3. I can't really, yeah.
Do you think, and again, I mean, I want to stress that, like, I've not brought you on here to talk about what you regard as one of your worst gigs ever, but do you think, what could you have done differently under the circumstances? What is it that didn't catch to you is there anything you could have done? Presumably you've spent some time thinking about it.
Yeah, I think that's what it is, isn't it? It's the regret over what you could have done. It's like you got to the crossroads and you just made the wrong decision. It's like you went down the wrong road and end up in the woods, you know, screaming out, hello! And you could have been on the main road hanging out with your mates. And it's like, and that's how it felt. I just went down the wrong road and stuck to my guns, as you say, and that wasn't the right thing to do. I should have been loose. I should have, because it was they were 3.5 hours in. I was on at about 10:30 and they'd been on since 7.
Yeah.
With Alexi Sale coming on and at the beginning. I built this fucking place.
Yeah.
And, you know, McIntyre coming on talking about windscreen wipers. And I'm like, well, they've had 3.5 hours of entertainment. And then I come on and talk about female masturbation. And it's like, it's too much. Just fucking take it in, you know? Just don't go into the thing. Don't just keep it light, keep it easy. And I just made the wrong decision, and that was the thing that hurt, I think. And it felt like the whole industry was there and had seen me be found out, which is always the fear, isn't it?
God,
I've been found out.
I mean, I had an experience like that many, many years ago when I'd just been taken on by a particular agent who then held an industry showcase. And everyone struggled because industry showcases are awful. But yeah. I died. I died in a way that, like, someone came and put their arm around me at the bar and said, well, they didn't like you very much.
Wow.
Like a friend, you know, came and said that, which was the right way to handle it. And years later, they said they really respected that I hung around afterwards. And I thought, wow. God, that's how bad it was. So I do know, I mean, I do know that feeling. The difference is that that was... like, that was kind of materially a death, whereas yours was simply not the glorious thing you wanted it to be. And
yeah.
I think you talked yourself into it being a death.
Or yeah.
You talked
yeah.
yourself into it having been a death. I think
maybe the word death is wrong. I think death is the feeling. It's the creeping sense of regret that feels like death. I think death is probably just too broad a word. It's more a sense of... there should be another word for having an experience that wasn't quite as good as you know it could have been. It's like
yes.
it's like having sex and coming too soon, and you didn't need to come, it didn't have to happen. You're like you're too old for this to happen now. Do you know what I mean? It's like that horrible feeling of, oh fuck, we were just getting started, and then she's lying there going, oh okay, no it's fine. I love you baby. We'll go again another time. And it's like that feeling of, oh, this could have been an all dayer.
Let's talk then about a career highlight, certainly a professional kind of career highlight. And I think you told me that you loved the gig when you did the Apollo. It was like one of your
yeah.
favourite gigs. Let's focus on that and more positive feelings.
Yes.
But still use them to get into your fucking psyche.
Yes.
So talk to me about that, because that was one of those that obviously that is kind of regarded as the breakthrough thing. After which, and this is how my mind works, after which presumably your money goes up. You know what I mean? That's like, you go on there, you smash the Apollo, you did really, really well. It's a great set. And again, it was a thought. It's just one of those things that showed you at your best. It's a thoughtful, intelligent set with big, big banging punchlines that are really original, and you can't imagine them coming out of anyone else's mouth.
Yeah, no,
A
it was
star, right?
It was an amazing gig, and I did do the female masturbation joke on that. It wasn't in the final edit, but it went well on the night. So
vindicated.
Yeah, no, it was an exceptional gig. It was really strange how well it went. I was on stage, and I came on, and I was on late again, so it was like the same sort of thing. About 3 hours into the night, the audience has had a lot of comedy, and I was standing behind the screen. You know, it's a very weird moment waiting behind the Apollo screen, you know, the thing that slides up when the comedian comes out, and the dry ice machine was all revving up. You know, I could hear the dry ice being prepared. I'm like, this is really, you know, behind the curtain here. And and then it just started lifting. And I was like, oh, here we go. And then suddenly I was on this stage of this thing that I've watched for 20 years. And I was luckily not so out of body that I wasn't able to, you know, be there. But it was just from about a minute in, I was like, oh, okay, this is going well. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, a round of applause. Okay, wow. Oh, another round of applause. Oh, this is lovely. Oh, people are whistling now as well when they're clapping. And then I got through the set, and a couple of minutes before the end, I just thanked them for being there and how special it was to me. I did a Tez Ilias. And I'm just a northern lad from Burnley. They didn't believe me. I thanked them before I'd even finished the set, and they started clapping, and they carried on clapping and clapping and clapping and clapping and whistling and whooping while I was just standing there. I was still doing my set, and I couldn't, it's that weird thing of taking when an audience is just giving you that love. It's just so like, what do you do? It's that awkward feeling of just take it, just stand there, be grateful, don't run away, because it's so tempting just to go, right, bye, cheers, bye. But I just stood there, and it kept coming, and it was really odd to just, all right, okay, great, thank you so much.
At some point you start looking over your shoulder going, has someone else come on?
yeah, someone's come to grab the mic, right, next, your next act. I finished in a sung share, and then I got a standing ovation, and I've never had a standing ovation in my life. So the one gig that I've cared about most, and it's happening, and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? It was so strange and so amazing. And yet I wasn't like, you know, when you're bouncing off the walls ecstatic and you're a bit of a handful, like in a sort of like a child, I was just kind of like zen. I was so zen because I was like, yeah, that's my act. That's my act. I just did my act.
I love that feeling so much when like you've smashed it, but you're not pinging around. You're going, yeah, that's what I do.
Yeah.
Thank you. I've done the thing I do.
Yeah, and people are coming at you going, fucking hell. It's like, yeah, I know. Yeah, it's like, it's not arrogance. It's just a kind of, yeah, but that's what I do all the time. And it was just nice that I could do that under the biggest pressure and just do my act and muck about and chat to the audience and roll around on the floor. And I did an impression of McIntyre that they cut out and just messed about and had a good time. So it felt like I came off and I went, oh, yeah, no regrets. Nice feeling, really nice feeling. And to know that I'd done it again in front of the industry, in front of the cameras. And yeah, I don't think Apollo is, people always say this, it's not what it was. You know, people don't obsess over Apollo. I don't know how many people watch it, but it still felt like a massive moment to have the best gig of my life on that show, you know? And that clip's there.
And was there anything in the, was there any part of the feedback loop, the kind of the Tom Ward critical self voice, did anything creep in afterwards, or was it bliss for a few weeks and then come back down to earth? What was the post-coital bit?
Post-coital was amazing. The 4 weeks, for about a week, or I'd say about 10 days, I was just floating on air, man. I was I felt amazing. And then I had a gig above a pub, you know, back to basics, back to the usual. And there was about 25 disinterested people in the crowd looking at me like I was on some sort of register. And then I just had a horrible gig and went home and I cried outside and I was just like, oh God, it's ended. The come down is here. You know, I'm quite an emotional person, as you can gather from that. But it was. And then now I analyze the clip and go, oh, that setup's a bit long winded. Oh yeah, that's a bit, wait, there's not a joke for 20 seconds. Why don't you just get to the bit, you know?
Yeah, okay.
But not too harsh.
And going into it, what was your sort of mental state in the kind of weeks beforehand? Were you kind of mithering over choice of material? Was it like, were you stressed by it, or were you feeling calm and honing it and preparing? What was that like?
I tried to just treat it like anything else, which was to not micro obsess, you know, not go through each word and go, well, I've been saying it that way for 6 years, but why don't we just maybe I'll try a new word for the Apollo people, because I've watched Apollo and I don't think they'll like that word, you know.
This is a very familiar narrative.
And then you get on stage and you're wearing trousers you never worn before, saying words you never said before, and you're like, why isn't it working? I did go through it, but I didn't fixate in a kind of way where you know that it's there. You know that the jokes are there. The bits that you want to do, you know, the producers have said, oh, we like that bit and we like that bit. And the BBC has said yes to that bit. And you're like, really? They said yes to that bit. And I'm talking about pansexuals. And they're like, yeah, the BBC have said fine. And it's like, all right. So I'm not going to just dismantle the whole car, you know, because the car's all right. The car has taken me a long way. And so I just tried to carry on as normal, but it was obviously on my mind every other thought. Basically, every other thought was, "Oh, Apollo! Oh, yeah, that's coming up." It was in my diary, and I was just buzzing. I felt like I'd had this pat on the back that I really needed. Someone said, "No, we do love you," you know. And it just, after everything with the whole world shutting down and mental health being so fucking bad, for to come out of that and get that call on a Monday morning when I've just had a piece of cake, you know, and I'm like, this is the best day ever. I feel validated. And I know, as we were saying, it's just like, can you feel validated without the world telling you you're wonderful? maybe one day, but for now, you know. So it was like, yeah, I was buzzing for weeks before, and I was buzzing for about a week after until the come down hit.
Your mental health is quite complex, as I understand it. I saw a video about complex PTSD that you did, I think, for the BBC. And I hadn't known any of that stuff. I thought you were kind of bog standard, communal garden, brilliant but self-loathing comedian. But that's some quite, I'm not, you know, that's some quite complicated stuff with regard to your upbringing and your parents and religion and all the other kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How are you, can you, do you mind talking about it? Can you sort of tell us where you are with it now? Because one of the things I'm enjoying about this conversation is you feel like you've got a handle on it.
Yeah,
I do. You feel like you've got a handle on your mental health. You've talked about therapy, I know.
Yeah.
And I think you've, and you mentioned you were kind of meditating or doing yoga, I think, meditating before this. You feel like you've kind of, you've grabbed your mental health by both hands. And I think that's, with both hands. Grabbing it by both hands would be kind of pointless.
Embodying my mental health with hands.
Yeah.
That helps me, actually, Stu. That really helps me to imagine that my mental health has hands and I can just grab them. It's taken time, but I've had to. I think it's also a case of allowing yourself to be who you are from moment to moment. And I didn't really understand that. I've got a new friend called Rich Hardesty, who's got a debut show at Edinburgh this year, and he's like a little boy. That's his energy. He's like, he's stuck in little boy mode, but in the best possible way, rather than, oh, mate, come on, get over it. He's like, he's stuck in the wide-eyed phase of life's amazing, people are amazing. And he's had a really difficult life, but his enthusiasm for life remains. And he's taught me that a lot of the stuff is to do with accepting what you need to be moment to moment. So if you're excited, be excited. No need to try and hide it. If you're sad, be sad. You know, I was always trying to mask it or hide it. And I think getting better at just saying to people, oh, I'm really fucked today. So the other day I had a gig and I had a meltdown in the daytime, and I couldn't stop crying for about 40 minutes before I was trying to get on a train, you know. A proper anxiety attack. Like, I don't know what it was. It's the thoughts. There's no thoughts attached. It's just a feeling, a horrible, horrible feeling. And I was, you know, just falling apart. And I was trying to get ready, trying to dry my hair and, you know, moisturize my face while I'm crying, you know, and all this tragic stuff. And I was like, all right, well, just go to the gig, do the gig, and just admit to everyone how you're feeling rather than, you know, keeping it in. And so I told the promoter, I'm really sorry, I'm really, really in a bad state. I told the audience, and the gig went fantastically well, possibly because I had been honest about how I was. And I was like, yeah, so I think I'm getting better at just being like, oh, I have depression. That's part of what I have. Sometimes I get attacked by this kind of brain thing where I just break down and I don't know why. And that's to do with stuff, presumably, that happened when I was younger. And it's sort of, it does feel like I'm being assaulted from inside, and it's not even just me going, oh, I wish my career was going better, or I miss my dad, or, oh, my mum wasn't very present. You know, I don't go into it based on a triggering thought. It's almost just like I'll wake up and go, fuck, I want to be dead. So I've had to really get on it. I've got a little Prozac now that I take every morning, antidepressant, and that's just brings me out a bit, and just being what I am moment to moment. It's like this whole thing, be yourself. No one actually tells you how to do that. They just tell you to do it. And it's like, for me, it's just about moment to moment. How are you feeling right now? And being honest about that and not trying to be cool, not trying to hide it. If someone's happy, doesn't mean you have to try and pretend to be happy. No one wins from that situation. You know, if you've got a grievance with someone, try and deal with it now. If someone's pissed you off, say it now. You know, just come at it with the intention of, right, let's try and fix this now, or let's try and address this, whatever this is, now, so that I don't have to go home carrying it and thinking about it and waking up regretting it, or having arguments in my head with some kid I went to school with 20 years ago about something I wish I'd said, even now. And all that stuff, which you carry with you. So, yeah, that's been a big part of it.
And is that kind of, you said before, the anxiety attack, I mean, that's not how necessarily what you named it, but that kind of, you know, that meltdown.
Yeah.
Didn't have like a kind of mental trigger attached to it. And that's sort of, that's interesting to me, because I think almost all of my meltdowns have got quite specific thought kind of triggers.
Yeah.
like, I don't know much. Is it complex PTSD that you have suffered from? Is that right?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I don't really know what that is. I watched your video about it, but that was a week or two ago. So I.
That's interesting that you have a thought attack. I think with CPTSD, it's like trauma is something that's activated subconsciously as well as consciously. So with PTSD, you can, if you've had, say, a soldier has seen something horrific at war, and then they're in the urban situation again, and they go past a car that makes a similar noise to the car that blew up or something like that, they get PTSD. Or they're on a loud train, or they're stressed because there's a lot of noise in the street and it reminds them of the situation. Whereas with complex PTSD, it's kind of insidious, it's subconscious, it's stuff that's happening without necessarily you knowing it's happening. So you can wake up, maybe you've had a dream that's activated this feeling that you used to have when you were going through the thing that happened or the things that happened, and then you're in that state. So a lot of the side effects are fight or flight. So you'll find that you're in a social situation which is essentially safe, but you'll find yourself in a flight state as if you're in danger. And it's not necessarily physical danger, but it's a type of emotional danger that you feel like you're about to be attacked, shamed, humiliated, left out. And it's like, well, I've got to get out. So for a long, long time, I was always just leaving everywhere. I very rarely stayed in a social situation for long because it would build and build and build until I felt like I was about to be cornered. So it's a more insidious, it's a more hard to place, and you just have to spot it and go, ah, that's happening. And admit you've got trauma. I didn't admit that I had trauma for a long time. I just thought, oh, trauma, that's a bit, you know, that's disrespectful to people that have actual trauma, you know, disrespectful to soldiers and frontline people and people who've had physical trauma. For me to bang on about emotional trauma is a bit wishy-washy and all that sort of stuff. But I thought, well, I can't deny it. This affects my life. I'm having regular meltdowns. I've had breakdowns. And it's like, well, eventually you've got to accept it and go, well, this is happening.
And what's the effect? What's the relationship between those sorts of feelings and meltdowns and what have you and those sorts of experiences and your work? Like, is there any relationship between, because if the fear of being attacked, the fear of being humiliated, that's something that I imagine exists within the sphere of how regular people see comedians. Like, most people don't want to be comedians because of the fear of being humiliated.
Yeah.
In part. So what is there a relationship between those things? Is it sort of a different, it's what you're describing sounds worse than dying on your ass on stage.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it may simply be that, you know, the comedy doesn't come near those sort of things.
It's weird, isn't it? It's almost counterintuitive for people who have anxiety to go on a stage and stand in front of a room full of people and put yourself in a very vulnerable position. But I think comedy, because you can essentially prepare and practice and rehearse again and again, you're not coming on cold, are you? You're not coming on naked. You know, you go onto a gig and you kind of have the armor of it being a fourth wall. And the armor of being rehearsed. You've said these words before. You know that you've done 1,000 gigs, 2,000 gigs. You've been here before, or you've been in a similar situation before. So you're not exposed. So it doesn't activate that part of my brain that feels nervous, like about meeting new people or going into a room and having to be socially engaged, because you're at a remove. You know, you might as well be in a glass container with mirrored, you know, with mirrors on the outside and them looking in. It's like you're not part of the room. You're separate from the room. You're facing the wrong way from the room. They're all facing one way, you're facing another. You're not part of the room. Do you know what I mean? You're not part of their experience. So it's like,
yes,
you have armor, you have your stuff that keeps you safe, whereas socially you're exposed. You're in amongst it. There might be people in the room who are more famous than you, more successful than you, better looking than you, that are drawing the attention towards them. And it's like your specialness is gone. You know what I mean? There's so many other little triggers that can make you feel like, oh, I'm not special here. I'm not wanted here. And it's like on stage, all that goes away, doesn't it, for a few moments.
Is there, this might be a difficult question, and it might be a complete barking up the wrong tree, but is there a relationship between the feedback that you've been getting about where are you in it and your desire to not be in it. Do you know what I mean? That, or not your desire to not be in it, but the fact that if comedy for you is a safe place because you have armor, then maybe what the director was saying is try to take off that armor.
Mm. Yeah, she was like, you're talking about class here. Why aren't you talking about what class you are? And I'm like, I'm implying it. It's implied. Listen, listen. Yeah. I prefer to imply than to say directly.
And that preference is an artistic choice rather than... Is that preference inflected by the need for safety? Or is it purely an artistic preference?
I think it's probably to do with safety, but I think it's also to do with not wanting to be defined solidly by any label. I don't enjoy that feeling. I don't feel sure enough in any of my labels, except, like you said, I think you were saying to Brett, this is the example I'm giving because it was the one I was listening to yesterday, about that's the one label he's proud to have, comedian. Mm.
Mm.
And a lot of other labels feel like they're coming at you from someone else's perspective. Oh, you're a da-da-da. Oh, you're da-da-da, you know. And it's quite, I don't like that feeling. I don't like being told what I am by people. As a rule, I find it a bit like, no, it's more complicated than that.
Mm.
So I think I prefer to keep it vague because that's how I feel. I don't feel solid. But other people will have opinions. They'll say, oh, you're a white, straight, middle-class guy or whatever. And I go, all right, well, fine, I've, you know. But that's not relevant to me. That's not, I'm not going around. It's like their label. Their desire to put a label on me sometimes feels like it's an attempt to contain me.
Hmm.
And I'm like, don't try and contain me. Just enjoy it. Let's enjoy each other. Can we sit in that weird space where we don't know everything and we don't try and reduce each other to where we were born, how old we are, what school we went to, what your dad did for a job. You know, it's like people, you can feel people fishing around. And you go, oh, you're not with me anymore, are you? You just want to know the stuff.
Yes. I had a very confronting a wonderful friend of mine called Hazel, who crops up from time to time on this podcast because I think she's very inspiring. We had our first children around the same time, and when I said, oh, do you know what you're having? She said, are you asking me what genitals my baby's going to have? And she was right, it was a very confronting question that made you go, oh yes, why do I care? Am I preparing myself to treat that child differently on the basis of their gender?
Absolutely.
Yes, I am. Of course I am. I didn't plan to. That wasn't intentional, but that is of course what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So I think there is that similar sort of territory to going, why do we care what your dad did? Why do we, like, I meet other kind of parent friends in my little kind of parental friendship sphere, and I want to know what they do. Why?
Yeah.
So I can decide whether it's better than what I do or not and treat them accordingly. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's an absurd thing, you know, but I think that's where that all comes from, doesn't it?
Yeah.
We're constantly trying to sort of pigeonhole each other.
Absolutely.
And I really enjoy the stuff that you've done on sexuality and the fact that you've talked about having had a relationship with men, but also I can't remember whether this was on your Apollo bit or whether I heard it on your preview, that you sort of framed it as, I think it was on the Apollo bit, you framed it as, I'm not going to say that I'm bisexual because I'm not putting the hours in. That's like saying I'm a volunteer.
That
I absolutely melted. I thought it was lovely.
Yeah.
Because there is such a temptation, particularly in comedy, to go, I am this, everyone, so I am available, not purely I don't mean it's cynical at all, but... I'm this, therefore I am available to these markets.
Yeah.
Like, of course that's part of the great seduction, part of the grand illusion, isn't it? That you say, you will enjoy this because of this. And actually to be not mysterious, but to be ambiguous is less of a sensible business decision.
Definitely.
But more true.
Yeah. And I don't know if more people are wanting to be like that and aren't, or whether they feel more sure of who they are. I don't know. whether, yes. you know, they're more sure of their brand or just more sure of what they are as a person.
Yes, I'm not. I don't. Don't
it's
get
hard
me wrong,
to know,
I'm not
isn't
for
it?
A minute suggesting that people are announcing queerness, for example, as a means of catching a wave. I don't mean that. But
no,
what
I know
mean
you don't.
Is, yeah, I just think that. I think that there is. It is of benefit to be clear about who you are. There
yeah.
are numerous benefits to that in terms of your choice of material, the subjects one goes after, you know, you know, things are simpler.
Absolutely.
If you are clear. And yeah. actually, it's, you know, comedy's fucking hard. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a way of making it simpler?
Yeah.
But I appreciate the ambiguity.
And I think, you know, this goes for all performance. You know, you watch a movie, you want to know what the main star's about. You turn on the first scene in a film is all about showing who they are, where they are in their job, what their relationship status is like. We try and getting a sense of the person as quickly as possible so we can go, all right, okay, this is a film about a 20 something man whose girlfriend's just left him and he's woken up with his face pressed against an empty baked bean can. He's not in a good place. You know, you're getting the sense of the person straight away, and we want that. And obviously that makes sense for people to signpost who you are, where you are, what your position would be, so that we can prepare and, you know, prepare ourselves. But I really enjoy not giving people those things. And it's not like an aggressive thing. It's just a case of, no, come on, we're better than that. We don't always have to. I don't have to come up here and say, so I'm Tom, I'm blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you can get a sense. And it's like, it's complicated. It's not, I didn't go to Eton. I can't say, oh, I went to Eton. That's my persona. You know, it's all over me. You can see that I've got the kind of Eton face and the Eton demeanor and I'm a posh boy. It's like, well, no, it's like, it's messy, you know, and if your story's a bit messy, then why would I suddenly polish it up and pretend that I'm this, that, and the other? It's never felt clean. It's like, you know, there's layers to all of the different labels that people have and want to put on you. And I've always found that and I remember a girl at a party saying, I bet you had a really like nice, safe, middle class upbringing. And I just found myself so annoyed by her. And I was like, all I had to say was, well, actually, you're wrong. But I just found that even the assumption made me furious. And I was like, fuck off. Stop trying to shove me in that little fucking attitude you have towards those people. And I'm very aware when someone's sniffing around for information. And I'm like, just let it go. Just hang out with me. It's all right. Don't run back to your assumptions. We don't need to do that. Someone asked me, you know, asking me my age. Why do you need my age? What are you trying to get? It's like what you were saying about what do you do? Is it as good as what I do? It's like you're trying to work out where I am in my life in relation to a number and then where you are in relation to me in relation to my number, you know, so you can go, well, I'm actually 10 years younger than you and I've already, you know, it's like let's just hang out and sit in that tension and enjoy the fact that we don't know and that we like each other and we're not running back to a safety little, you know, safety place where we have the facts.
How ordered is your mind for writing, for work, given that you're... I think my assumption is it's almost like when I said that you know, you sort of seize your mental health with both hands, you seem to be on top of and in control of the things that keep you calm and happy.
Yeah.
So, do you know what I mean? Like if you're meditating or exercising and Prozac in a different way, you know, or whatever it is, I know what's good for me and so I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Rather than I know what's good for me and I just can't do it. Like a lot of us, you know?
Yeah, I'm all about doing the things that are good for me. I'm really, really, really good at that. I've always been quite good at pushing back and saying, no, I don't want that. So yeah, I'm all about the, you know, I don't go online in the morning. This is rare for me. I'm on Zoom here. You know, I wouldn't normally open my laptop till midday, half midday. I don't have a smartphone.
You have a burner, don't you?
Yeah.
I remember you saying, yeah.
Yeah.
You've deliberately got a burner so that you can't get... I mean, that's what we should all be doing. That's what the people who invented half the fucking apps do.
Yeah.
They make sure they don't have any... connection to them. Yeah. So you're only contactable at your laptop, which is work hours.
Yeah, yeah. So I go to a cafe during the day. I do my admin. I open my laptop, and it's exciting though, because there's stuff to see, because I haven't checked it since yesterday. So it's like, oh, cool, you know. And then I go, oh, a few emails, and go on Instagram, and then I turn it all off, and then I'm just at the cafe for a few hours, maybe 3-4 hours sometimes, and just going through the set, or if I've got a preview, going through and listening to previous things, and maybe changing some tunes in the show or whatever, and just make sure it's all off, phone is off, and then turn it all back on about 3:34. So yeah, I treat it kind of like a job, but I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that feeling of concentrating on it and not having interruptions and not getting sidetracked by nonsense, because it is nonsense, a lot of it. A lot of the stuff on the internet is just really, what is it giving you? It's just,
oh, it's not just nonsense. It's nonsense that's been designed by people in labs to catch your attention.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? It's not just, it would be bad enough if it were just random.
Yeah, it's cunning. It's strategic. And it kind of like fragments your brain. You can feel your brain going against itself, and it's like, I know how good I feel when I do one thing at a time and do it properly, and I'm with the person I'm with, or I'm reading a book or whatever it is. I don't live a fucking monk lifestyle of simple pleasures. I'm out having a good time, but it's just, I know how unsatisfied I feel if I am not doing the thing fully. So if I was checking my phone when I was talking to you now, it would just take away. It would just wouldn't be as good, because I'd be like, my attention would be split. My emotions would be split between expecting and hoping to hear from someone, or checking to see who's been in touch. Mm. And then the emotional fallout from that, and then talking to you at the same time. It's like, that's where we are at the moment in our culture. And it's like, it's not necessary. It's not inevitable. You can say, do you know what? You're not gonna fuck with my brain, or you're not gonna get to me. I can just shut you off. And it's not a conspiracy, though it is slightly conspiratorial that they do set up these apps to manipulate your emotions. It's not a conspiracy theory to say that they're trying to get to you, because they are. Mm. But it's not necessarily that they're evil incarnate. They're just cunning businessmen and women. And it's like, I just prefer to, cut it off as often as I can.
Are you ambitious?
Yes, but I'm not quite sure what for. There's not a crystal clear image of it. It's just more, and I'll know when it's the more that I want, and it's better than the thing that I currently have. But it's as much to do with just wanting to keep doing the thing. Because there's always something, isn't there, on stage that you haven't. It's like, oh, I want to. Oh, and it's like starting again. So it's an ambition to keep going and for it to be a bigger scale. But I don't know where the end point is.
Is there another act that you secretly feel or worry you are a bit like, or a bit in the footsteps of?
Yes, I worry that I'm a Sean Locke, a little bit like Sean Locke, maybe. But that's only recently hit me, because a couple of people have noticed it, and I was like, oh shit. And you worry that maybe you've stolen your whole thing. And I worry sometimes that there are just someone like Finn Taylor is just bang dealing with the stuff, bang, and it's like, I worry that you're a light version.
Yeah.
You go, oh well, he's doing the big thing and I'm just doing the sugar free bit.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a very honest worry to accept. I think a lot of people, I like asking that. I don't ask it so often, but I like it because I think, of course, absolutely all of us do. And you'd be insane not to have secret worries that you're a light version of other people. But yeah. That's very well put. Thank you for being so candid about that.
No worries.
Which comic would it be most narratively satisfying if they killed you?
Ooh. Oh, God. Narratively satisfying.
If
they killed me, it would have to be an enemy on the scene, wouldn't it? I've only got a couple of enemies, and yeah, Oh, God.
One of your enemies.
It would have to be. I don't know. Would it?
You don't need to name them.
Well, I can't name them. But
I'm fascinated you have enemies.
I have one enemy, main enemy on the circuit, and we don't even acknowledge each other, and it's all a bit unfortunate in a lot of ways that I can't go into.
No, okay.
I'm sorry, that's a real... No. Next time on ComCom, Tom opens up exclusively about his enemies.
This is how to get yourself rebooked in a few years.
My story, only in ComCom.
What is the bit that you are most proud of?
I really enjoy, there was a bit I used to do about Tupperware, which I really enjoy. But again, it's from another time. I think the stuff on Apollo about pansexuals, that went really well and I felt really good about it. And I didn't really get any heat or being told I was phobic or anything like that, which is important. I think, yeah, that whole bit about gender blindness and the changing face of sexuality, that felt so good. Gender and sexuality, you know, having a revolution and how that plays out in the real world. I feel really good.
What's the biggest thing about which you've changed your mind over your career in comedy? The biggest thing about comedy, which you changed your mind on? It's a very hard question. I just sort of riffed that one.
I think that I allow myself to have opinions, and I didn't think I was allowed to have opinions. That's from my personal point of view. Do you mean in comedy in general?
No, let's stick with the opinions thing. Tell me more about what you mean.
I just feel that it's all right to have opinions, that I'm not stupid. I used to feel very stupid and that I wasn't really allowed to have an opinion because there were clever people that had opinions, that had read more and been to university and stuff. And I was like, well, you can't have an opinion because you're just not. So just steer clear of opinions. But now I allow myself, or I have opinions that I'm not embarrassed or ashamed to say.
Last one. Are you happy?
I'm happier than I've ever been, but it's not something I count on, and it takes work every day, and I take it seriously, the work that needs to be done. But yeah, I am. I'm in a good place.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
So that's Tom Ward. Come on. What an absolute corker of an episode. And as I said, that just that lovely balance between he's brilliant and he's brilliant at making stuff and delivering it and performing it. And it's just great. And he's not sure that he is. And he's sort of navigating this constant mental health journey that we are all navigating to a greater or lesser extent, quite a complex one in his case. More on that in the Insiders Club sections, the extra content from this and all of the episodes that have them, which is getting on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of stuff available to you whilst you support the podcast. And lots of people, let's not forget, support the podcast and never get round to downloading any of the stuff. That is very welcome as well. comedians.com/insiders. Look forward to Tom's show at the Monkey Barrel, 10:25 nightly. It's called Anthem. I've heard a preview of it. It was incredible in preview. I dare say it will be even better by the time you see it. My own show, A Shared Illusion, a work in progress at the Monkey Barrel in just the first week at 1:25. And that's that. TomWardVoice.com to find out more about Tom. StuartGoldsmith.com to find out more about me. Join the mailing list and so on, and enter an unfathomable web of links, some of which go to interesting places, but they cannot be returned from. It's exciting, isn't it? And finally, my YouTube channel has launched. I've got some help to put together a YouTube channel, a structure, a regular release schedule, all of those things I should have been doing for 10 years. Can you imagine if I started doing them properly 10 years ago? Let's not cry over spilt internet. But you can find that. We don't. In fact, you can find it by looking for it, because at the moment we're still just finishing getting a unique URL so that I don't have to go to youtube.com/klmzthxdts3xcly. I don't go there. I mean, God knows what that is. But that is coming your way very soon, and I will of course start linking to it in all the usual places. Next week we have Jenny Bede, and then we have a little break while I go to Edinburgh, do a show, see lots of stuff, and then either record podcasts there or set up the recording of remote podcasts afterwards, and we'll be back after summer. I hope you have Well, I hope you have a lovely week between now and the Jenny Bede episode. And at the end of that one, I'll tell you all about the lovely summer that I hope you have. Thanks to Tom. Thanks to Nathan Wood for editing and producing the show and all that business. Thank you to Moz, our brand new logger. Your podcast consultant is Peter Dobbing. And this podcast is brought to you by the Foundation to Keep Hercules British. All right. So that is that. And I'm going to talk to you now about school reports and weather in the postamble coming up shortly. But if you're leaving, cheerio. And if you're staying, let's speak in a few seconds. Hello. So my son got his school report, and of course, I'm not going to tell you the details of Boutros's school report, save to say that we read it aloud to him and teared up. myself and mummy teared up. Well, I teared up. She did that lovely fluttery thing where you sort of fan your face. But I was absolutely in tears just because it's his first proper end of year one, first proper school report. And so lovely to hear someone say nice things about your kid. But look, I come here not to praise nor even to bury Caesar, but just to ask about and to inquire about how would you, if you had to do 120 school reports? Or no, is it 100? No, it's 60. 30? I don't know. Per class. I guess one teacher does their class. Call it 30. If you had to do your school report, how automated could you make the process? Because this one felt, it was brilliant. It was brilliant from the point, I mean, it's a lovely thing to read, but also brilliant from the point of view of the teacher, fabulous teacher. But if it were me, I would have built all manner of, I would have learned to build or got someone to build me a system whereby, and I was talking to my friends about this morning, and when I briefly wrote continuity on a freelance basis in between the TV programmes on the UK TV network, very briefly for a weird sort of summer job that got slightly out of control, I used to write them in Excel. And in Excel, you can create loads of little deliberate autocorrect things. So, you know, you can set it, if you constantly misspell the phrase comedian, for example, you can type the thing you normally type and it will, and set it to automatically change it to the, you know, disaster, set in disaster tray if you continually misspell disaster, and it'll flip it to the right thing. You can also type, you can create your own codes, right? God, I saved countless man hours. Not person hours, because it was me doing them. They were, like, so I would type in CU space, and it would automatically jump to coming up tomorrow on this channel. And so I just saved myself a huge wodge of time until eventually they changed the system, and I couldn't really admit, I couldn't be like, hey, can we go back to the old system, please? Because I had all these personal shortcuts that allowed me to get all my work done by lunchtime. Can't really say that, as far as I understand it, in jobs. So surely you would want to do the same thing with a school report if you had to write similar, nuanced, tweaked, but there'll be sections that were the same. What a joy that would be if you could get good enough at the system. I suppose you only do them once a year as a teacher, so you don't do that. But listen, what I'm saying is, so as to not simply pontificate, if you're a teacher, let me know if you do that. And if you don't do that, you should do that. You could set in little codes, THG space, and it would mean this pupil is absolutely breathtaking in their imagination and and in the way they treat others, but their personal hygiene is disgusting. Three simple letters, bit bop, like that. And you could just create loads of codes and then stick it all together. That was fun. Was that worth talking about? I'll never know. So a little tip there, if you use, I think it's in Excel, but it'll be something like that. If not, I was going to talk about the YouTube channel, but yes, in mentioning it in the middle bit, I realised that we don't officially have a URL, a bespoke URL for it. So I'll just kind of wait and tell you about that later. But it's good. Gosh, it's great to have help. The Instagram stuff continues. It continues, and after that initial, I mean, if you listen back to an episode from 2 months ago, you can hear me just off my tits going, oh my God, I'm huge online, guys. And now it's a very different story, which I think is, I feel pretty sanguine about it. When you kind of open the batting with two or three massive viral successes that get millions, then you're naturally, the next few are going to do well. And then I think we've filtered down now to 4,000 plays per thing. And God knows what a play is. Maybe 4,000 plays equals five people watching it to the end. Who knows? But I think they're starting to slowly build back up from there. So I need to maintain the mindset And listen, let's not even talk about that. Look, if you've made it through this and you have an Edinburgh show, this is a public service announcement. I might even do, I probably can't be bothered to do a special episode about this, but maybe if you listen this far, either keep this information, if you're a fringe going comic who's doing the free fringe and soliciting any kind of donations, either keep this to yourself if you're callow, or tell other people that you think deserve to know. In chatting to Diane Spencer, fabulous comic, lovely person and previous guest on this podcast, I kind of mentioned in passing that I think this year, the Free Fringe, and I hope this one comes out before you're already up there. I mentioned in passing that in the Free Fringe, if you're soliciting donations and you're using an iZettle or whatever the equivalent sort of contactless technology is, last time, pre-pandemic, last real Fringe, I think, or last time I did the Free Fringe, I was getting about 20% or 30% of people who wanted to pay doing so online, maybe 35% tops. I think this year that's going to be more like 70 or 80%. Now, I'm doing pay what you want this year, so there will be a small, you know, contactless element to it. But, you know, it's not, I'm not doing it in anger this year, as a funny expression given the circumstances. I'm not up there for a month desperate to pay the mortgage this year. I'm having a nice, soupy, creative experience. Hooray for me. But if you're up there desperately trying to make money, as many of us are, Jesus, what with the accommodation prices and all of that stuff that we know, I think it's worth bearing in mind that you are going to get a lot more people who want to pay contactless. A lot more people won't have cash in their pockets. And whether or not that's the case, I think it's worth preparing for. So why not do what the walk-by buskers do, what my friend Steve Aruni does, he who plays music, brilliant original music, with a small robot Henry the Hoover that you may have seen on the London Underground or elsewhere in the country. What he does, I believe, is that he has a board onto which he has glued two or three preset iZettles. We're talking an outlay of no more than £100. So you've got to be confident that you're going to be earning something at the Free Fringe. But you set them to whatever your price points are. I, you know, would suggest £3, £6 and £10, say. And that way, and already those hustlers among you are thinking, I could leverage those price points to see what people, you know, let's do some experiments. And I know that the, Nigel Ung is beyond this now, but the data scientists among you will be thinking, I could change them daily and experiment with them and work them out. So go and do that. But get a board, glue two or three iZettles to it and say, you can pay instantly by pressing your card or phone against this, because otherwise I think everyone is going to end up with a huge bottleneck, of people. There are going to be first week traumas as people realize that the incoming crowd can't come in because the exiting crowd haven't paid yet, because so many more of them want to pay on contactless. All right, I'm going to clip this bit out and I'm going to put it on the Facebook group to reward people for their diligence, because we should be having this conversation, I think. Probably I'll just type it rather than clip it. Yeah, that makes sense. So I believe this episode is going to come out on or around the 28th of July, which means that you've got that weekend to get your iZettles and get your hot glue gun. Cannot recommend a hot glue gun enough. What an investment. You can just stick things to other things. Changes the world. If you get a hot glue gun and a concrete breaker, you can change the world. Something to think about. Anyway, have fun. I hope you'll make loads of money at Edinburgh. And I'll be back next week with Jenny Bead, which will go out in the very beginning of the Edinburgh Festival. The official launch date, the 4th, I think, where I will be doing a technical rehearsal at 10:30 in the morning, which I imagine will be very short. See you there. Tom Ward, remember, is on the Monkey Barrel all week, all month rather, but not every night at 10:25. And I'm there from the 4th to the 11th, just that first week. I hope I'll see you there. I can't wait to see you. Come and say hello. Goodbye. Lovely ending.